Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoeffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. The St. Louis Bridge, completed in 1874, is the oldest remaining bridge across the Mississippi River. It is popularly known as the Eads Bridge after its designer-builder, James Eads. In this bridge, Eads pioneered the use of steel, which was then a new material, the construction of long-span arches without falsework, and deep underwater foundations. Eads and his international collaborators created an elaborate financing scheme intended to pay for the bridge and assure large profits for themselves and their fellow investors. The Eads Bridge is in active use 150 years later, today carrying four lanes of road traffic and the Metrolink light rail line across the Mississippi. To bring us the history of this National Historic Landmark is John K. Brown, whose recent book, Spanning the Gilded Age, James Eads and the Great Steel Bridge, presents this history in detail. John is Professor Emeritus at the University of Virginia, where for 23 years he taught history, applied ethics, and writing in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society. John earned 3 degrees in history, a BA from Emory, MA and PhD degrees from the University of Virginia. John, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, and I want to say before we start, your book gave me many hours of interesting reading, and I particularly appreciate your including in the book a description of the decades-long process you followed to write it.
I'm glad to be here and glad to talk with everybody about this great bridge and this great engineer.
Well, we're looking forward to this conversation. It seems to me there are two intertwined stories here: the design and construction of the bridge itself and the financing schemes and financing scheming, if I could use that term, that drove the project through to success. Is that a fair description of this picture?
Yes, I think that is true. And then the third element I would add is that I try to use the story of the bridge, its design, construction, finance, to shed light on the broader context of the country at large in the decades after the Civil War, a period of real, rapid, fundamental change in American life.
Well, your book certainly does that, and I appreciate that. I'm sure other readers will as well. So let me go back and ask a simple question. Who was James Eads? What brought him to the bridge building? What were his qualifications?
So it is sounds like a simple question, but it's really the sort of central tough nut to crack, because he's such an amazing, unusual figure. So he doesn't have much formal education, leaves school at the age of 13, and then has an amazingly innovative career that unfolds over the next 60 years and unfolds in quite distinctive chapters. So James Eads was a man who was amazingly audacious. He would take a chance where you and I would not. He was very charismatic. People wanted to work with him. And he was capable of mastering new fields by his own disciplined mind. So those traits carried him along from one success to the next. He didn't always succeed. Sometimes he was so out on the edge with his ideas that they didn't work out. But for the most part, this was an amazingly successful, audacious innovator, in part also because he mixed engineering talent with talent in finance.
So that is a really interesting mix. One of the things that occurred to me is, was it typical in that day and age that the designer-builder got into the money side of the project?
I don't think it was quite typical. I think you had the entrepreneur finance guys typically on one side of the table and the engineering innovator guys on the other side of the table. So to mix those traits was unusual, not unheard of, but it certainly was unusual, in part because both of those fields are so churning in development at that time. So to be good at both is not easy.
It's just amazing to me that the investors put so much faith in him, given that he hadn't built a bridge before. And then he really, if I could use the term, went off the edge in terms of innovation and trying new ideas. Why would they go along like that? I mean, it seems to me that typically investors are more conservative.
Well, certainly that's a point I try to make in the book, that it is fascinating. So Eads convinces a London banker, J.P. Morgan's father, Junius, to float the bonds for this bridge. So here's Junius Morgan. He's way off in London, 4,000 miles away from St. Louis. He's backing a design by a neophyte civil engineer. Eads had never done a bridge before, a design that's going to require steel, never used in a bridge before, and a whole bunch of other pioneering, but Morgan backs him. And the answer to your question, why do the investors back Eads in this project, I think really comes down to three things. In the first place, the bridge project has a charter that gives it a monopoly. So if they get this thing up, they know for 25 years they're going to have monopoly profits. So that's pretty enticing. And the second factor is Eads structures the deal so that the investors can, if all works out right, make 400% on their investment. Well, that's a number that tells you this is risky, but it also is an alluring, enticing prospect to make that kind of return. And then the third factor, which I think really does motivate a lot of these people, is they really see themselves as betting on the future of the country, that they see America's on this really impressive growth trajectory, especially after the Civil War. The fate of the country has been cleared up in that Civil War. And they see America is destined for greatness. And that's another factor in why they will put their money down on such a project.
But it seems to me, as I recall what you wrote, that there were a variety of points in the construction of the bridge where things were right at the margin. Things were not going well. And yet the investors knew that. I was fascinated by the fact that you were able to dig up the documentation, the conversations that the investors were having, not with Eads, but with each other. But they still kept in the game.
They did. And in part, they stayed in the game because the way the deal was structured, they wouldn't get their big return if they bailed early. So if they sold their stock early, they would disqualify themselves for the bonuses that were written in the deal for stocks and bonds. So that's one reason why they stick with it all. It's interesting as a historian. So I wanted to tell the finance story because nobody's ever done that. So literally, we had no idea. We have no idea how these projects got financed. No historian has peeled back that material. And one archive in London was very generous for me in giving that information. So on the one hand, I'm telling a lot of finance in the story, but on the other hand, it's a book of 10 chapters, and finance really only dominates two of those chapters. So I wouldn't want listeners here to this podcast to think this is only about the money. It is about the money, and I think I say some interesting things about the money, especially because it sheds new light on young Andrew Carnegie, who is central to the deal. This is before Carnegie's in the steel business. So the money story is fun and fascinating. I like to think I tell it in an interesting way. But there's an awful lot of engineering, culture, urban history, other aspects to the story.
It's a very rich book, and I, as I said, I was much fascinated by reading it. I guess I want to take you – let me just make a comment about the money side of it. What you say, based on my observation and my reading, is that this book is unique in the sense that it really does dig into the finance side, and you motivated me to go back and try to dig around and look at writings about the Brooklyn Bridge. McCulloch's famous book about the Brooklyn Bridge is probably the dominant source. And my recollection is he doesn't mention money at all. So that makes what you've done really interesting and different.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you mentioning that. So, of course, David McCulloch sets the standard for great historical writing and, for that matter, for the accounts of bridges. But yes, McCullough doesn't touch on the money side at all. You can read all 600 of his pages and not really realize that the Brooklyn Bridge was built by a private sector for-profit corporation. So he stays away from these topics, in part, I think, because he just wants to tell a good story. And I'm not going to sit on the sidelines 30 years later and tell you there's any fault in David McCullough. But I will say, for a professional historian, we want to do more than just tell a good story. I hope I tell a good story, but I also want to broaden out what we understand about how Americans succeeded in the things they did 150 years ago.
So let me take you back to the word monopoly. How did they build this monopoly out of this project? You mentioned the franchise from the state of Illinois, which presumably precluded anybody else from coming in and building a bridge. But there were other elements to this monopoly.
So business leaders of that time talked up a good game about free enterprise and competition, but whenever they could, they structured their companies and their industries to avoid direct competition, because it just hurt their profits. So in this case, the bridge company has this guarantee from the state of Illinois that no other bridge can be built for 25 years into St. Louis, Missouri. So that's one level of the monopoly. Then the bridge company signs exclusive contracts with railroads that say the railroads can have access to this bridge, but they may not, to abide by this contract, they may not use any other way to get over the river. So there, the bridge company is using contract law to enforce its own exclusive lock on a market. In that case, the railroads chose to break those contracts, but that's how a business of the 19th century could use the law, in that case contract law, to try and protect its own markets. Carnegie would be very good at this. So was Western Union. Western Union became a national telegraph monopoly by using contract law to ensure that nobody else could take on its privileged position.
But the railroads, as I understand it, committed themselves to using this bridge, which was a guaranteed source of revenue. Am I remembering that right?
Yep. So that's true.
But they walked away from that.
Where the bridge was finished. And then they walked away from those commitments. And so what shows you there's some limitations here to how you can use the law. So those railroads did break their clear, binding legal commitments to put traffic on the bridge. They came up with an excuse to justify breaking their commitment. The railroads of Illinois said correctly that their charters given to them by states, it's important to remember, then and now, corporations are not chartered by a federal government. They're chartered by individual states. So the railroads of Missouri said, when they didn't want to use the bridge, they said, well, we did sign that contract, but we're chartered by Missouri, and our Missouri charters don't give us permission to run trains in Illinois. And the Illinois railroads said the same of Missouri. So in that scenario, the bridge company, which is desperate for business, and it could, in theory, have sued those railroads in U.S. courts or state courts. But that would not have put trains on the bridge anytime soon. It just would have ticked off their potential customers. So they chose not to sue.
And ultimately, how was that resolved?
Well, ultimately, what happens is the original backers of the bridge, Eads, the Morgans, St. Louis investors, they thought what they were doing was building what amounted to a toll highway, where they would charge a toll for railroads to use the tracks. When the railroads refused to do that, the bridge insiders, the bridge investors, the company realized, we've now have to become a railroad ourselves. So when they start that in 1874, it's really the most unusual railroad in the country. It owns 3 miles of track that cost $15 million, $1874, vastly expensive. So not surprisingly, the finances don't work out very well to begin with, But over time, by the late 1870s, this setup is actually a great advantage for the city of St. Louis and for area railroads, because this operating railroad that runs trains over the bridge hauls all the freight and all the passengers through the city of St. Louis and through East St. Louis, Illinois. So it becomes this unified service that connects each railroad and industry with all the other railroads and industries. So what started out as a problem in 1874 turns out by the 1880s and 90s to be a great advantage for the city of St. Louis, and propels a great deal of economic growth for the whole region. St. Louis grows from number 6 among U.S. cities to number 4 by 1900. Its rate of growth doesn't quite equal Chicago, but Chicago's a one-off. Its rate of growth is nonetheless really quite impressive, and it's thanks to the connections provided by the bridge and the efficiencies or the services provided by this one railroad connector, which by 1900, that railroad is known as the Terminal Railroad Association of St. Louis. But it operates the bridge, the stations, the yards, and connects everyone to everyone.
So effectively, they built a bridge, an operational bridge, as well as a physical bridge. That is, and they added several components to this to make it work end to end. So you mentioned the Union Terminal. There was a tunnel. There were yards. It seems that they built all that infrastructure to make that bridge work end to end, east side to west side.
All true, and they built all that infrastructure to protect their own monopoly. So there was a competing bridge that finally opened about 1890, I think, or so, roughly. Even before that merchant's bridge opened, its backers sat down quietly at a table to fix prices with the owners of the Eads Bridge. Then, later on, in 1893, the owners of the Eads Bridge take over the merchant's bridge. So this unified system is, on the one hand, we see these issues to this day, that you have this unified system which can promote efficiency and better service, but it also reflects a monopoly power over, and in the case of St. Louis, the Terminal Railroad literally controlled the movement of every bit of freight and every passenger through a metropolitan region that was among the nation's largest. So, and the terminal would tell you that this was all about efficiency, but the newspapers, Joseph Pulitzer, the U.S. Antitrust Department, looked at it all and said, this is yet again a monopoly that is controlling a vital crossroads of the country.
And that Terminal Railroad Association still exists today.
It does. It still exists. It still provides exactly the same kind of services that it did in when it started in the late 1880s. It is the key link that connects railroads east and west. America is a bit unusual. Until quite recently, there were no railroad systems that really connected, that ran across the whole country. There have been mergers in recent years that have changed that dynamic. But even so, the Terminal Railroad operating in St. Louis is a key connecting point for the major railroad systems of the country, for all of the major systems, although there are not that many of them now. They've merged themselves together. Of course, the whole passenger railroad situation changed dramatically when the Terminal Railroad opened its new Union Station in 1894, the station that still exists. When it opened that station, it was the largest railroad station in the world. And trains of every railroad that served St. Louis came into that station thanks to the Terminal Railroad. And the net effect of that, though, was a great convenience for travelers. So if you were arriving in St. Louis from Milwaukee and you were heading to Texas, all you had to do was walk across a platform. If you were making that connection in Chicago, you'd have to change stations, trust your life to a cabman who's going to be working hard to rip you off. So St. Louis got a lot of advantages out of the terminal system over many, many decades.
I think one of the terms that you reminded me of in your book was Union Station. Union meant that all the railroads were connected through the same station. And we see these Union Stations now in quite a number of cities around the United States.
All true. Union Stations, that was one of the questions I really wanted to understand. When did this become commonplace to have Union Stations? The answer I found was they exist in the middle of the 19th century. Indianapolis was the first city to have a Union Station, I believe, in the early 1850s. But they're rare really until the 1890s or later. So throughout the 19th century, railroads saw themselves as locked in vigorous competition with each other. In the Midwest, there was such vigorous competition in the railroads that served St. Louis that they would have price wars, that there were something like six railroads that all ran parallel routes and trains between St. Louis and Chicago. And when they were locked in price wars, the prices would fall to ridiculous levels. So getting railroads that think of themselves as competitors, getting them to sit down and cooperate in coming together in a union station was really quite rare when Eads pulled that off. Eads is projecting a union station for St. Louis in 1867. That is, you're right. The meaning is a unity of the railroads serving a region, a union of the railroads serving a region. And St. Louis derived many, many advantages from that union station for many decades.
One of the things you write about is the fact that during this period that you describe the development of the bridge, railroads didn't interchange cars. I see that as a kind of parallel to the Union Station idea, that if you integrate these multiple businesses into a system, you get huge efficiencies, economies, and you give a better service to people. So this is a period of what I would say is rapid change in the development of the industry.
Quite so. It's the interchange of freight cars obviously depended on a standard gauge, the distance between the rails. It depended on a standard coupler, which comes really in the 1880s. It depended on standards for air brakes. So it's easy to see in 1870 or so why you want these kinds of standards and interchange, and it's really hard to pull it off. The other issue, which I discuss in the book, beyond the technologies required, you have to have agreements among the corporations about how you're going to handle the cars of another railroad. They called them foreign cars. And it's kind of fun to think that until they came up with those agreements, railroads acted as you might expect. They were very self-interested. So it was pretty commonplace for the Rock Island to have cars coming onto its system from another railroad, say from the Pennsylvania Railroad, and the Rock Island held on to the PRR cars. Why would it send them back? It can use those foreign cars to make money. So that was a really tough nut to crack, but they worked on it throughout the 1880s. And by the 1890s, car interchange was widely in use and celebrated as an essential part of the system for creating a national railroad system. We don't really have a bunch of companies that work across the country, but making those companies into a system, a unified system, is really the work of about 30 years from the late 1860s into the late 1890s. And the net effect for American business, for the economy at large, was really amazing.
We're short on time, but I want to ask you a couple of questions about the design itself. And I would let our listeners know that one has to read the book to capture this picture. There's just so much information in it. What were the risks of his using steel? Why did he decide to go in that direction?
So thank you for calling out the book. Let me just say, while I can, there's 85 pictures in the book. So the things that I describe in words in the book and here, you get to see in the 85 illustrations. Why Eads chose steel really goes back to who he is and his audacity, his willingness to innovate. Everybody told him at the time that steel was going to be a problem. In Britain, where Bessemer steel was born 20 years before it came to America, in Britain, the British Board of Trade banned the use of steel in bridges until the 1870s. It was too risky, too experimental. But Eads was just entranced by steel's qualities. So compared to the alternative, wrought iron, steel promised more strength at lower weight. And strength at lower weight really matters a lot when you're building a bridge. So that, I think, was the initial reason why Eads was drawn to steel. And then the other factor is Eads thinks the real problem for a bridge at St. Louis isn't going to be the superstructure. He's worried that the real problem is going to be the piers, the stone foundations that hold it all up. Because Eads knows the river. Eads had a career in salvage. The river at St. Louis, especially in the 19th century, was a ferocious thing. Now, remember, the dams of the Army Corps of Engineers are 30 years in the future. So the river at St. Louis could rise or fall by 40 feet, did rise and fall by 40 feet across the year. In the winter, it would freeze solid and have literally 7-8 foot thicknesses of ice choking St. Louis and devastating anything that was on the shore, boats, things like that. So for Eads, the piers are the key challenge because he needs them to withstand the currents. And when you start there, then your next thought is, well, let's make as few piers as we can, and therefore we're going to need long, long spans, and their steel seemed to Eads to offer a great advantage. I will say this. The book shows you didn't have to build a steel bridge. There were very, very competent engineers that were in competition with Eads who were offering fine designs in iron. But Eads, who's a total neophyte, pushes past those competitors and makes a steel bridge happen. But that's a part of the story that I emphasize in the book. Eads is competing against five other projects to build bridges over the river at St. Louis. Projects offered by really, really competent engineering talent that included John Roebling, for example. So how Eads, the neophyte, manages to put his own unique design up and best the central figures of American civil engineering is another marvelous dramatic part of the story.
And I guess I want to say it is a marvelous story. It's a complicated story. You've done a great job of pulling it together. It's very clear that you've invested a substantial part of your own career in building this story. And I encourage people to get the book and to read it as I did. I just want to ask, what's next for John Brown? Do you have another book in mind?
I do have another book in mind. I have a book. I'm changing gears entirely. I'm going to be writing a book about an episode late in the Second World War, a story that involves American and German aviators near the end of the war. And I don't want to say more about it now, but it's a great, marvelous, dramatic story, and I've already started work on it. And I love the idea of writing a popular book that tells an untold story.
Well, you've set a high standard in the book about the Eads Bridge, and we appreciate that. And I thank you for spending the time with us this morning. I'm going to go back and page through and remind myself of the pictures, which are an important part of the book. So thank you very much, and congratulations on this success.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you and this audience.
Very good. Thank you. Bye. Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.